Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Monday, the 13th of February, these are our main stories. The UN's aid chief says earthquake victims in northwest Syria are being ignored by the world. Arrests in Turkey for involvement in suspected shoddy construction work exposed by the disaster. And massive protests accusing the city authorities of destroying the Spanish capital's healthcare system. Also in this podcast, Nigeria's military rejects government accusations that it's planning a coup as malicious and wicked, and
the winner is Harry Styles.
Harry Styles!
The one and only Harry Styles.
From Grammy Award winner last week, Harry now sweeps the board at the UK's biggest music awards, the Brits. The United Nations has warned that earthquake victims in rebel-held areas of northwest Syria are being let down by the failure of the international community to send help. The UN's aid chief, Martin Griffiths, says people rightly felt abandoned almost a week after two massive earthquakes destroyed thousands of buildings. Manar al-Kabutli lives in the town of Al-Atarib in Idlib province in northwest Syria. She's described what the last week has been like to Julian Marshall.
We cannot cover all the damage by ourselves. The border crossings, they were closed 4 days after the earthquake. No aid was delivered. We need medical aid. Our hospital cannot cover all that injured people.
How are people sheltering from the cold?
They are still sitting in the streets with their children. They are literally shaken out of cold.
Have you lost anyone as a result of the earthquake?
My cousin lost his house with seven children and their mother died. He could just rescue two of his children.
What are you being told about aid? Are you being told that it is coming?
There are so many promises. They tell us that there will be aid coming out of the crossing line with the regime. But it's too late for that. It has been like a week, a whole week, and people in the streets, and people died, and people injured. There is a lack of equipment. It is not impossible to remove the rubble, okay? But it takes us too long to remove it. The people die, and we cannot reach them in the proper time.
Who do you blame for this lack of aid reaching Al-Atarib?
Other countries in the outside standing and looking and watching us dying without doing anything. Why are we like useless people here in Syria? Why are they ignoring our pain? We post too many photos, like videos, saying that we are in pain. We are losing our children. We are losing our families. Why no one helped us? They sent us papers for children while we need to extract those children from the rubble and to save them from dying.
Manar al-Kabutli speaking to Julian Marshall. Our correspondent Quentin Somerville has been travelling around rebel-held Syria and sent this report.
The main street in Idlib's harem is gone. They waited for help here, but none came. It was here that Fadil Gadab's aunt and cousin's families all died.
There is no one alive here. We just need them to come in and dig the bodies up for burial. I don't know what else to say.
We travel further west. There are no aid convoys here, few signs of relief, but a lot of urgent need.
This was the town of Bethania. These were people's homes. They were newly built. 80% of this village is gone, and they've had hardly any help since the earthquake struck.
More than 100 homes have gone here, and much more besides. Abu Ala lost two of his children.
I started running like a madman in the streets, shouting, "Dear God." It was then that I saw my wife and 7-year-old daughter alive. I kept on running in the streets until I saw them. She told me my children were gone.
Islamists are in control here. We were accompanied at all times by armed men who didn't interfere with our work, but it's made getting aid here more difficult. At the Bab al-Hawa Hospital, they've no time for politics. With few staff, they've had to treat over 350 earthquake victims.
There's not enough medical staff to help people in normal situation without earthquake, without any bombs, without any war. There's not enough medical staff.
Down the hallway lies Mohammed Gayath, just 3 months old. His parents were killed by the earthquake. He was found in the street by a neighbour. Mohammed is all alone. And Syria, too, again feels forsaken, disregarded by the world, in another hour of need.
Quentin Somerville. More than 33,000 people are now known to have died from the earthquakes in Syria and Turkey, and the UN fears that figure could more than double. Thousands of displaced people in Turkey have set up tents as close to their ruined homes as possible to try to prevent looting as the authorities seek to maintain order across the disaster zone. Jens Lerke is the deputy spokesman for the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Speaking from Gaziantep, he said the chances of finding people alive are fading.
The death toll keeps rising tragically. Once in a while, we hear of live rescues. That is, of course, encouraging. But we do believe we are at the end of that phase and at the beginning of the much longer humanitarian relief phase that must kick in.
My colleague Caroline Davis has just arrived in Adana in Turkey. Earlier, I spoke to her about the conditions there.
Many people are still living in the cold. They have no permanent accommodation, they have no running water, they have no electricity, and many of them don't have access to adequate meals. According to the UN, more than 800,000 people still don't have access to adequate meals. So in terms of the situation here, it might be a week on, but the situation is still obviously not resolved. It is potentially going to continue, and more people are going to be in very, very difficult circumstances.
And more than 100 people arrested for what are described as building code violations. Tell me about this.
Yes, so this was an announcement earlier today that there were 113 arrest warrants, according to the Turkish authorities. 12 people have been taken into custody, according to them, including building contractors, and more arrests are expected. This is already being seen by some as an attempt to potentially divert blame for the disaster, because there's been a lot of criticism about the number of buildings that have collapsed here in Turkey, and that there's been some suggestion this is to do with the fact that there were government policies which included something called so-called amnesties for contractors that allowed them to swerve building regulations to encourage construction, to grow a construction boom. And that was also taking place in earthquake-prone regions as well. And as you will have seen, the enormous amount of damage that has been done across this border area between Turkey and Syria, you'd have seen hundreds of buildings that have collapsed during the earthquake. And that has, of course, raised questions about whether or not these buildings were made safe, given that they were in an area that was known to be hit by earthquakes.
Caroline Davis in Adana in Turkey. The warning from Israel's head of state couldn't be more stark. We are in the midst of a crisis. President Isaac Herzog has decided to intervene in the fractious debate on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's controversial plans to overhaul the judiciary. In an unscheduled televised address to the nation, Mr. Herzog called for calm.
We all feel that we are at a moment before a collision, even a violent collision, that we are on the verge of an explosion. I wish, I beg of each and every one of you, brothers and sisters, the threats from outside are great enough. Any sort of violence against those who are elected is a red line that we must not cross.
President Herzog was speaking after weeks of protests against the proposals, which Mr. Netanyahu's opponents say undermine the independence of the judicial system. He argues that he and his far-right and religious partners have a mandate for change after winning the last election. On Monday, thousands of people are holding another mass rally outside the parliament. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yoland Nell.
The tone of political debate in Israel is the most acrimonious known in years. Tens of thousands of people have been joining weekly protests over planned judicial changes. Today, hundreds of private companies are allowing their staff to join a general strike. Members of Parliament are due to vote for the first time on a bill that would grant the government full control over the appointment of judges, including to the Supreme Court, and severely limit the country's highest court's ability to strike down legislation. Critics claim that the overhaul will upset the system of political checks and balances and undermine democracy, while the Prime Minister, who's facing charges of corruption, which he denies, argues the plan will restore balance between the branches of government and stop judicial overreach.
Yolande Nell. Now to Madrid.
Manos arriba!
Manos arriba! Esto es una...
Hands up, this is a robbery. The chants of 250,000 people demanding better healthcare, led by doctors and nurses. They gathered in the centre of the Spanish capital in a huge protest against the regional government's management of local healthcare services. Carrying placards saying the right to healthcare is a human right, they accused the regional government of destroying the city's healthcare system. Our reporter Guy Hedgeco has the details from Madrid.
It really was vast today, and we have seen a number of strikes by doctors and nurses recently, and there was a similar demonstration, a big demonstration like this one back in November. So people who work, or many of the people who work in the healthcare system in Madrid, are unhappy. And they say that the local government is dismantling the public healthcare system. Spain's healthcare system is devolved to the regions. Each regional government controls the healthcare system. And critics of the Madrid local government say that Madrid spends less per inhabitant on its healthcare than any of Spain's other 16 regions. They say that it puts far too much emphasis on, for example, building hospitals rather than actually filling them with personnel. It says that it's underfunded, that waiting lists are growing and have been growing for some time now. And the main problem that the people who are out in the street today say is primary care. So that's general practitioners, pediatricians, accident and emergency. And they say that this is coming to a head. This crisis is reaching a point where the system could collapse. That's the charge that they are making.
What does the regional government say?
Well, the regional government is run by the Conservative Popular Party, and it says that its healthcare system is perfectly good, that its policy is working. However, the president of the regional government is a woman called Isabel Díaz Ayuso. She's a very divisive figure, and a lot of the people who are out on the street today say that she is absolutely the wrong person to be in charge of their healthcare sector. So I think this is going to be a big issue going into the regional elections, which are coming up in May.
Guy Hedgeco. It's almost a year since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, causing death and destruction, threatening European and global security and impacting food and energy prices around the world. But what's happened to Russia itself, the country that started the war? Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, has spent 3 decades living and working there and looks at how much it has changed in a year.
1 year of war has been devastating for Ukraine, but also a disaster for Russia in terms of military casualties, the Kremlin having to declare mobilization. The invasion went badly wrong for Vladimir Putin, but defeat, he won't contemplate that.
I think he's prepared to go very, very far until he decides that he has won.
Historian Nina Khrushcheva believes that imperial ambition is fueling Putin's war.
He counts himself as the successor of the great emperors, Peter the Great, Catherine the Great. I think Russians are inherently imperial because they never dealt with the fact that their territory can be smaller. Their territory is giant. It's 11 time zones. And in many Russians, you hear that often, it's a great country. So a great country means powerful country, country that has sphere of influence. And we hear it from Putin often.
But can a country be great if it's doing what Russia is doing? Recruiting convicts, among them convicted killers, to fight in Ukraine. And in a great country, do mothers say the kind of things I heard Muscovite Viera telling me about her son?
I'd rather my son was killed fighting in Ukraine, Viera said, than see him getting up to mischief at home. Just look how many young men here have no job and spend their time boozing. Is that the choice now for Russian men? Die from drink or on the battlefield? What has happened to Russia, to Russians? Political scientist Andrei Kolesnikov points out that what Russians are saying is heavily influenced by what they're hearing on state TV.
Propaganda is so strong, so ubiquitous, that people begin to repeat literally all these clichés which are coming from the top, from officials, and from Kremlin talk shows on television with this horrible language of hate. So, and because of that, they begin to consider Ukrainians as not human beings.
We've seen a lot of death and destruction in Ukraine. What has been destroyed in Russia?
I think the moral fundamentals of the nation. Right now, immorality, cult of violence, becomes a social norm, and this is a big trouble for Russia.
It is also a great irony. For years, the phrase I heard more than any other from Russians was, anything but war, we don't want a war. So traumatized was this nation by the memory of the Second World War. Nina Khrushcheva, too, has noticed a change.
It's the country that always says we want peace. It's the country that fought in World War II and was seen as a liberator of Europe. And now this is the country that bombing a country in Europe. History will look at it badly and we will look bad. Whether Russians will be able to accept that horrible guilt, I don't know. I hope they can and they will.
That report was compiled by Steve Rosenberg. Still to come on the Global News Podcast.
As a journalist, you're rightly constrained by the facts. What's interesting about this book, though, is it's not entirely all fiction.
From BBC correspondent to novelist, Martin Patience tells us why he switched from Mike to Quill. So, what's going on with flying objects? I only ask because another has been spotted and, by all accounts, shot down, this time over the US-Canadian border. That follows two others above Alaska and Canada that may or may not have just been balloons. The sightings began with a Chinese balloon that was downed last weekend in US waters amid accusations from Washington that it was being used by Beijing for spying. I asked our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes, what on earth is going on?
Well, there isn't much clarity at the moment. What we have now are three objects shot down over the last 3 days. Alaska, Canada, and now over Lake Huron in the state of Michigan, which, of course, is close to the Canadian border. We understand that this latest object was first detected over the state of Montana on Saturday, and it has been followed by the authorities. The decision was taken and ordered by President Biden out of caution. And we are hearing that officials do not consider it to have been a military threat. No indication that it had surveillance capabilities, but at this stage they can't rule it out. We're also hearing that it was of octagonal structure, but had no discernible payload. In other words, there was no significant structure attached to it. And of course, that is the key interest of the authorities. What are these objects carrying? Could they be carrying spying devices, or could they be relatively innocent? Are the authorities, some might suggest, overreacting to things that have been floating around in the sky that have always been there, that now because of the sensitivities over these, certainly over the balloon that was brought down last weekend, clearly everyone is much more nervous about these kinds of things.
They were very quick to blame the Chinese for the first balloon, but there's been no such accusation with any of the others.
That's right, and I think that's because they are still trying to retrieve the wreckage, what remains of these other objects. And certainly, as far as the operation is concerned off Alaska, And that goes back to the object that was downed on Friday. The weather conditions there are extremely difficult, a short period of time of daylight, it's extremely cold, so that's hampering that particular operation. We've heard in Canada from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau that a similar operation is under there for wreckage, but they haven't found everything yet and haven't reached any conclusions.
Peter Bowes. Nigeria has a long and inglorious history of military coups. There have been five since independence in 1960. Now, there's talk of another one being planned in the run-up to presidential elections on February the 25th. The charges come from an official of the governing APC party, who said generals last week held a secret meeting with a rival presidential candidate. The army has described the allegations as wicked and malicious, as our reporter in Abuja, Chris Iwaka, told me.
The Nigerian military has now come out to debunk the allegation, angrily saying that there's nothing like that and that it was a kind of a malicious fabrication of statements. And it was intended to tarnish the image of the military because the military, according to their spokesman, Major General Gusau, said that the military is loyal to the Constitution of Nigeria and it will work to support all the agencies that are concerned with the conduct of the 2023 election in Nigeria. In the statement by the army spokesman, while dismissing the claims that the army is planning a coup, he warned that those who seen fabricating or spreading such information would be invited by appropriate law enforcement agencies to substantiate their claim. And obviously, it's an indication that it plans to look for the official of the governing party who may have raised the flag and then maybe get the police, for instance, to arrest him and ask him to explain what he meant, what he has, and how he came by the information he has sent out to the public. Because I can tell you that this allegation has also added to the worries in Nigeria.
There will be people who maybe suggest that this is the government perhaps trying to just distract attention away from the fact that the country is going into this election with the economy in quite a state and serious instability.
Currently, Nigeria is struggling to cope with insecurity. The country is faced with jihadist insurgency in the northeast of the country. It's also battling with armed militia group in the northwest that they call bandits who had engaged in kidnapping and attacks in some areas. And beyond that, as the Central Bank of Nigeria recently pushed out a policy redesigning the local currency and asking the people to return old notes to the bank, this has created some form of economic crisis because now the old notes have been pushed to the banks, the new notes are not available, and people are suffering queuing at banks and at pay points to try to get some new notes to survive on a daily basis.
Chris Iwaka in Abuja. The Black Panther movie franchise has won audiences across the world, but France's defence minister has accused its latest offering of falsely representing French soldiers who fought in Africa, where the film is set. Daniel Mann has this report.
From Tarzan to Superman to Captain America, for decades Hollywood's biggest superheroes were white. But in 2018, the blockbuster superhero was black and African. The film Black Panther earned its makers, Marvel Studios and Walt Disney, more than $1.3 billion. T'Challa, the king of Wakanda, has superhuman strength, while his country had highly advanced technology, thanks to the fictional metal vibranium on which it had a monopoly. But French interests, it appears, want to steal it. In the sequel Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, French men wearing desert camouflage uniform raid the Wakandan Outreach Centre in the West African state of Mali. One shouts, "Where are the vibranium tools?" Seconds later, the men are fooled by Wakanda's elite force of female warriors, the Dora Milaje, which set them a trap.
Aneka, where is your spear? Should it give me this to try?
The film, which has grossed more than $800 million since it was released 4 months ago, proudly shows that Africans are shrewd and brave enough to fight off their former colonial masters. Wakanda may also be fictional, but Mali is where French soldiers recently fought and died. France's Defence Minister, Sébastien Lecornu, wrote on Twitter, "I strongly condemn this false and deceptive representation of our armed forces." He retweeted a clip from the movie, which was posted by Jean Bexon, a journalist who took to Twitter to claim that the film's evil French mercenaries were dressed like the French troops who took part in the anti-jihadist Operation Barkhane in Mali and neighbouring countries. Soldiers or mercenaries, the depiction of the French in Black Panther Wakanda Forever has touched a nerve. Mr. Lecornu added that he was thinking of and honouring the 58 French soldiers who died defending Mali at its request in the face of Islamist terrorist groups.
Daniel Mann. Next to a man who spent his career checking facts and then delivering them to a worldwide audience as a BBC foreign correspondent, but who's now moved into the world of fiction with the publication of his first novel. Martin Patience was a correspondent for more than 15 years with postings in Jerusalem, Kabul, Beijing, Lagos and Beirut. He could have set his book, The Darker the Night, in any of those places, but instead he chose to return to his native Scotland. He explained why to Julian Warwicker.
I think as writers, as well as journalists, we're always seeking out dramatic stories. And one of the biggest issues facing Britain at the moment is a potential second Scottish referendum into independence. And I just thought that would be a great backdrop to set a story against, a kind of critical juncture. Scottish independence is an issue that divides families and continues to divide the country. And I think it's reached a kind of new level of nastiness, unfortunately, and that can make it unpleasant to discuss the topic.
Talk me through the transition between being a man who's sought out facts and communicated them and now has arguably the luxury of adding some fiction to that.
I think luxury is the right word. As a journalist, you're rightly constrained by the facts. What's interesting about this book, though, is it's not entirely all fiction. It's actually based on fact. I read a magazine article more than a decade ago about a political murder that took place in South America, and it electrified and gripped that country. Some people might think the plot is outlandish, to which I would say, well, it happened and it could happen again, particularly in a period of political polarization, which we're seeing across the world, where people don't believe the institutions, their governments, or even the media. It's very easy for accusations and rumours and mistruths to take hold. In many ways, we are living in a great age of mistrust.
Without spoiling it for those who are yet to read it, I think it's fair to say that when it comes to referendum number two, things don't quite go according to plan.
I mean, without wanting to give too much away, a political servant winds up dead in Glasgow, Scotland's biggest city. And then it turns out, according to him, a video goes viral on social media and he accuses the First Minister, effectively Scotland's leader, of carrying out his murder. The big question is why, and the book unspools from there.
And what about the transition of moving to fiction? Is it a very freeing process?
I think one of the great things about fiction is it allows your imagination to run riot. I think one of the biggest challenges for journalists is that we don't allow our imaginations to run riot. We often spell things out. And I think one of the biggest challenges in writing books is in order to entice the reader in and keep them hooked, you can't spell things out from the start. So I had to unlearn many things. I also did a lot of TV. And the rule of TV is you don't describe what you can see because you have pictures. But of course, in books, you need to paint the picture. And I think the biggest challenge I faced was actually the characterization. You need to find characters, develop characters, and really understand them. And I wrote most of this book when I was actually a correspondent in Beirut. And I realized I'd made real progress because I was sitting in my kind of rundown coffee shop. And I realized that if the characters walked into this coffee shop from my book, I would know exactly what coffee they would order and what characters would actually turn around and walk back out of the place.
Martin Patience speaking to Julian Warwicker about his book, The Darker the Night. The British singer Harry Styles had a night to remember at this year's Brit Awards, winning every category in which he was nominated. The former One Direction star scooped 4 awards, including the coveted Album of the Year and Artist of the Year prizes. Our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson reports from the ceremony at the O2 Arena in London.
And the winner is Harry Styles.
Harry Styles!
The one and only Harry Styles.
This was the night the Brit Awards well and truly became Harry's house. Harry Styles dominated, winning all 4 categories in which he was nominated. Song of the Year for As It Was, Album of the Year for Harry's House, Pop Act and Artist of the Year, a category which had been criticised for having no female nominees. He used his acceptance speech to name those he believed should have been rewarded.
I'm really, really grateful for this, and I'm very aware of my privilege up here tonight. So this award is for Rena, Charlie, Florence, Mabel and Becky. Thank you so much.
The night's other big winners were a female act, the Isle of Wight indie duo Wet Leg, who were named Best Group and Best New Act. On stage, their singer, Rhianne Teasdale, spoke about the lack of female representation in the music industry.
Man, this is so scary, as being on the telly can feel like such a boys' club thing.
Beyoncé was a double winner in the international categories, but the 2023 Brits will always be remembered as belonging to Harry Styles. 3 albums into a solo career and having won Album of the Year at the Grammys on Monday, this week has seen him cement his status as a global pop superstar.
Thank you, Brits!
Colin Patterson. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Martin Baker, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.